Hey everyone, and welcome to tonight's edition of Was It Worth It? As you may not know, or you already do know if you've been listening to this show, shockingly, Toffer has not seen any known legendary or popular movies. I'm as shocked as you are. Anyway, tonight we find out, are the films and cultural touchstones that we hold dear, are they actually any good? Have we been wasting our time dressed like a douche at Comic Cons? Is the reason girls won't talk to us because your social awkwardness growing up has now manifested itself into adulthood because you've always been dressed like a Klingon, Han Solo or Jack Sparrow? So this week, we find out, Escape from New York, Toffer, was it worth it?
He's like your new podcast voice, is he?
I'm trying to sound as much of a dickhead as possible so we get as much like...
Just talk normal, mate. It's like a revolving intro. Like the show, just the intro changes week in, week out. But it's part of the show's charm, I think. So this week's film is 1981's Escape from New York. Yay.
Yes, it is indeed.
Should we do a bit of the plot? Oh, go on. Do your shit, man. Do your shit.
Well, no, I was going to say it's a very popular cult film, even though I think cult is probably the wrong term for it, because it's been a lot popular than kind of like one of those super small films that I guess cult means a very small and focused group of fans know and love it. But everyone I know that's seen Escape from New York, it's very much a favorite of theirs.
Yeah,
it's certainly one of my favorite films of all time. I think top 20, maybe even top 10.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it was directed by John Carpenter, of course, who did many, many films.
Mm.
Well, let's go through a few of Carpenter's films and see if you've actually seen any of them. You've seen, obviously, Escape from New York. Have you seen Dark Star?
No.
You're fired. Have you seen Assault on Precinct 13?
I've seen the remake.
Get off my show. Your show! Have you seen Halloween?
No.
Elvis?
No.
The Fog?
No.
Escape from LA?
10 minutes of it.
Trick question. The Thing. Yes. Christine.
Yes, I've seen
You've seen The Thing, okay. Yes. Christine.
Yes.
About the killer car, that's good.
Yes.
Starman.
The book's half decent as well. I've read the book. No, I haven't seen Starman.
Big Trouble in Little China.
No.
I'm just making notes here for future shows. Prince of Darkness.
Nope.
They Live.
Nope.
In the Mouth of Madness.
No. I've seen Ghost of Mars.
Ah, well, we'll get to that, because that actually has an Escape from New York connection. But obviously, you've seen the film. Toffer, what was the story about?
In 1997, when the US president crashes into Manhattan, now a giant maximum security prison, a convicted bank robber is sent in to rescue him. Ooh.
He's not reading this off a piece of paper, folks, I assure you.
No, it's on my computer screen.
God damn it.
So, yeah, we're in 1981, but we're not, because we're in 1997. Well, what they presume 1997 would be-ish, sort of, maybe.
I see. Please continue.
That's the end of the plot, mate. That's all I've got, really.
Kurt Russell is being deposited into the world's maximum, I assume, or at least America's maximum security prison.
If it's got to be the one and only, really, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Are we assuming that the prison's elsewhere in the country, or is this just it?
Well, there is in Los Angeles in this film universe, but you don't really get to that until kind of like the earthquake of LA, which kind of splits like Los Angeles off from California, basically.
Yeah.
And that's when you have the kind of slat remake, which it was like attacked critically and by fans because it was like a remake of the first film, Escape from LA. But Snake Plissken is a bank robber. There's actually a deleted scene that if anyone has got the DVD or Blu-ray, you'll see him kind of like robbing the bank, and then he escapes onto the subway and gets sadly caught and his partner killed. But he's basically an ex-war hero. From what we understand from the film, he's like very famous. It's like the running joke throughout the entire film is like, Snake Plissken, I thought you were dead. Like four or five people ask him that.
Heard you were dead.
So he's obviously a very famous criminal / war hero. He's obviously deposited into, God, stop saying obviously, Ethan, deposited into this new maximum security prison where the entire island of Manhattan is walled off. and is now a giant prison. Sorry, what were you saying?
Deposited as well. You've dropped that in a couple of times.
Yeah, I said that twice. I repeat words. What can I say?
It's fine, I don't worry, man. Do you, boo-boo.
Before, though, he's about to be convicted for life into an unknown and evil criminal underworld where criminals run and rule the lives they have made and created within the prison, as said in the film. Uh-huh. Snake is given an offer by none other than Lee Van Cleef. Lee Van Cleef obviously is important to the story because he was famous for doing many of the spaghetti westerns for Sergio Leone, and that's obviously what Kurt Russell has based his performance off. He's very much in the mold of Clint Eastwood's Man with No Name. So that's where he's got that kind of like very kind of under his breath delivery.
Yeah, he says everything in the same tone.
The president of what?
Everything's like this. Mm. I'm tired. Mm.
So yeah, he's given an offer. Go into the prison and rescue the president who has just been deposited into the...
Obviously.
No, he's just been essentially kidnapped and hopefully is still alive according to his life-signed vital wristband, which is assumed still on his person. Go in and get the president. You've got 24 hours before the Hartford summit meeting, which is about like nuclear energy. If you don't do this...
Yeah, that's still quite vague, isn't it? We still don't know 100%.
It's vague enough, but I think it essentially means if you don't get this guy out so he can deliver his speech or his angle on this to the world leaders, they're going to go to war and it's going to be the end of the world, basically. Uh-huh. So Snake agrees. Now, to ensure that Snake gets in, gets out, and does the job he's been asked for, he's been unwittingly injected with two... God, what are they, like seismic explosive charges?
Yeah, they're like little, like tiny charge. Yeah, they're enough to blow a decent hole in his arteries, apparently.
Yeah, that's it. He'd be dead within a few seconds. So he's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. So he goes in to rescue the president. Along the way, he meets a kind of like, and picks up, I guess, like a band of misfits along the way that help him in his quest.
Yeah, it is quite an ensemble, isn't it, really?
It is. I mean, it's... I think it's one of the better and more lauded films of the 80s. I mean, what compelled you to actually see it in the first place? I didn't say you should watch this as the next episode. So how did you come across watching it?
I'd watched The Thing and I enjoyed Kurt Russell a lot. So I thought, well, I'll check out some more Kurt Russell films. And it was between this and Big Trouble in Little China. And because I think we had mentioned it at some point, because you mentioned Snake Plissken. And I was like, who the fuck's that? So just from that, really, like, he's interesting enough to look at. I see him cosplayed all the time.
Yeah, well, he's one of cinema's like great anti-heroes. You're not supposed to be rooting for this guy, but I think strangely, as you go through the film, Snake's the one with the most honor and like greatest moral compass. So he's perhaps misunderstood by the powers that be. He doesn't like authority. He doesn't really care. I mean, in the film, at least, he doesn't care if anyone lives or dies. He just wants to kind of take care of himself.
Or gets raped,
yes. that woman gets dragged in through the floor, the chock full of nuts by the crazies, which is like this great...
He just walks past it. Like, nah, I ain't got time for that. You get raped, right? Yeah, she'll be all right.
Yeah, but I guess despite all these, like, on paper awful things, he's like this, like, super likable character, and you're rooting for him to kind of escape from New York. Mm. But yeah, it's weirdly, it's Kurt Russell's favourite role. He revisited it He'd love to go back and do it again. I think he still could. I mean, after watching him in Guardians of the Galaxy, I still think he could pull off an ageing, grizzled, like even more pissed off Snake Plissken again. But I think
more pissed off. Fuck yeah, he just grunt.
He does.
He didn't have much dialogue in the film at all, did he, really?
He doesn't. I think that's kind of one of the great virtues of the character. I mean, there's a lot that doesn't need to be said with a character like that. And again, like, he literally took the template from Clint Eastwood's Man With No Name for the three, especially spaghetti westerns, and like hang 'em high. So, I mean, this character archetype has very much been in, I think, cinema, literature, but particularly cinema for many, many years. I mean... Yeah, I mean, a lot of the archetypes from those films are like imprinted and like written across Snake Plissken, like, or through him like a stick of rock. And as I said, Kurt rips off or homages big time Clint Eastwood's character. But yeah, you're right, he doesn't have a lot to say. And I think because of that, that's a great strength. So you kind of like, I guess you're projecting a lot onto him as well, going, what's he thinking now?
There's enough going on around him, but there's enough characters around him that you don't really need him to... You don't need to hear his story from him. It's nice and ambiguous that you can sort of work it out. Well, try and work it out for yourself. Like, he's a very mysterious man, isn't he? Mm. Like, everybody knows him, but you don't really know why. And like, even if you don't know him, you've heard of him.
It's true. Well, I think the character's behaving around him fill in any blanks she might have about the character as they kind of like either betray him. I don't know. I think even how they think about him changes by the end, and he kind of gains some sort of respect in the eyes of the people who are still alive near the end of the film, at least. Or
there aren't many.
There aren't many, even though I guess at the end the president kind of like blows him off essentially, and that's where he kind of switches the tapes and kind of like fucks him basically and destroys the world, so to speak.
Yeah, lol.
But there's a lot of like really good character actors in there. In fact, to connect it to Alien,
yes,
three shows back, you've got Harry Dean Stanton as Brain, who's the guy in charge of like pumping all
Harold.
The... Don't call me Harold. And there's Adrienne Barbeau with the giant jugs.
Boobies.
She gets the Mountain Swamp Thing, but I can't remember if they're any good or not. Yeah. And she's in Creepshow.
She's got good hair as well. Like it's very, like, to look at it, you can look at this film and go, whoa, it's 80s.
It's big 80s hair. It's a bit like, again, to connect it to Alien, it's a bit like Sigourney Weaver's hair in the first Alien.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Who's your favourite character in the film?
Cabby.
Yeah, I was about to say Ernest Borgnine, he plays Cabby. He's, I think, my favourite character.
Fucking love how happy he is to be watching that show. He's having the time of his life. Like, fuck prison. I'm loving this.
Yeah, there's that kind of weird amateur dramatics version of... God, I think... You know what? Someone write in and tell us what the show is. I think it's either Pirates of Penzance or something.
I don't know, but I love that if you leave prisoners, you know, you leave them to their own devices, and they're gonna make a musical for you. I like that. They're going to get dressed up and put on a fucking show.
There's rapes and things happening in the basement of the theatre, but upstairs it's a very happy and jolly time of jazz hands and spirit fingers.
Yeah, well, Cabby's loving you. So when did this film first come into your life? What was your first experience with the... I was going to say the thing. It's not the thing. It's Escape from New York.
I don't know. I think I must have seen it at least in the very early 80s, or at least on TV around like 83, I think.
Yeah.
And it just kind of... stuck with me to the point I think the thing was around at the same time.
Why did it stick with you? Why? What was it about?
I don't
know.
There's just something like deeply cool about Snake Plissken, and I think the mix of the visuals and stuff and the look of the film, the idea I think is like one of those it's one of those weird ideas when once you see it, you go, God, that's such an obvious genius idea. Why had no one thought of it until then? But I mean, even John Carpenter tried to remake that very film with Escape from LA and kind of missed the mark. So it's just one of those lightning in the bottle, I think, perfect films. It's low budget, of course, but it doesn't feel like that low budget, but it feels like it in a good way.
Yeah.
And of course, I think perhaps the thing that props up the entire film is the music, and the music in Escape from New York.
Oh, it's tremendous.
It's awesome. Just the theme tunes and all the cool like early 80s synth stuff, which I think is kind of coming back now. There's a lot of like new bands coming out with a genre called synthwave.
Yeah.
And it's all very much inspired by that kind of John Carpenter, Alan Howarth, you know, stuff. I mean, Carpenter was originally a musician anyway, and I think that was his dream and idea.
Yeah.
And then failed upwards into film directing. So, I mean, have you heard any other Carpenter scores?
He did Halloween, didn't he?
He did Halloween, yeah. That's his like famous one. He did, like I said, The Fog, didn't do The Thing. Any American did that. But he tried to kind of like copy the Carpenter style, and he did it pretty well.
They had a falling out though, didn't they?
I'm not sure. Tell me more if you know more.
Well, because we've recently done a Was It Worth It of The Thing with Paul from the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews. Movie and TV Reviews podcast. He mentioned something that they fell out because John Carpenter went and changed it slightly.
Yeah,
he wasn't happy. Like, I think he sped it up. I can't remember the exact fucking...
Oh, so he did some post-production on his work, and he was like, that's not happy. Okay.
Something like that. Anyway. But
I'll look into it.
The Escape from New York thing reminded me very much of, like, a Mega Drive game. And, like, straight away, I was fucking in. Like, as soon as it comes on, and, like, you see where it's telling you what's happened. What the fuck do you call that?
Oh, the kind of like the prologue when it's going. The New York Maximum Security Prison. The music's really cool there. I think when the Duke
Jamie
of
Lee
New York,
Curtis, that is, isn't it?
It is. That's her voice. Yes, well done.
Yeah, I picked that up. And then I'm reading about it. I was like, oh, yeah, definitely is Jamie Lee Curtis. I think she's the voice of the prison as well.
She is. Yeah, when she says, follow the yellow line if you want to be terminated before depositing
that's good,
the prison
that
for
is.
Execution.
I thought that was fucking mint. You could just walk off and go, yeah, fuck this shit. I'm like, just kill me. Kill me now. Because they can't, like he says, then once you're in, you can't get out.
No. Well, those guys try to escape, don't they? And they get blown up by the helicopter.
Yeah.
Yeah, it costs $6 million to make. and it grossed 25 million. So it was kind of like a sizable hit compared to the budget it had. To keep the budget down, John Carpenter went to New World Pictures, which is the company owned by Roger Corman at the time. Jonathan Demme, of course, who went in to write Silence of the Lambs, was kind of like one of his stalwarts.
I've seen that. I have seen that one.
Well, working on this, all the matte paintings and all the beautiful kind of effects work, which still stands up even to this day.
Yes.
The matte painter, as you mentioned, I think before we started recording, was a small independent filmmaker who's struggling even today, James Cameron.
Ooh.
So, yeah, I mean, there's another scene, you know, when he's kind of like coming into New York and he's like looking at that like computer readout and you can see the city and stuff.
They did this really clever, didn't they? I was reading about this earlier. Okay,
yeah, they couldn't afford computer graphics, so they kind of painted the model of the city black and they edged it all with kind of reflective or neon tape and then filmed it under black light.
Yeah.
So it looks like some amazing kind of computer schematic, but it's all that kind of like, what is it, elastic bands and chewing gum filmmaking that kind of makes it look good. And it still looks amazing even today. There's very few things, I think, even though you can see it's an old movie, there's nothing that makes it look, oh, God, that's a bad effect and stuff. Maybe there's a couple of bits with
just the hair
coming in. Kurt's kind of got the same hair. He's got the same hair in this year's Guardians of the Galaxy 2017.
Yeah, just shorter and grey.
It's just a bit of salt and peppery, but he's still got this like quaffed mane of like amazing hair.
That is, I love that word, quaffed. That's quaffed. A great word, that is. But there's a reason to say, like, me watching it for the first time, there wasn't a lot that I could see that, like, I'd roll my eyes at and go, oh, that looks shit. Just little tiny things, like when the glider fell off the tower, that looked a bit
shit.
Yeah,
the spin.
Yeah, but other than that, there wasn't a lot that didn't really hold up for me. The very 80s punching sounds stood out, though.
Yeah.
Like, when has a punch ever fucking sounded like that? And who decided? Because one person's obviously decided that, and then the studio's gone, yeah, fuck it, everyone, every film will have it now.
One thing I thought was absolutely cool, but looking at it now, when he's getting trapped and those kind of crazies that she calls him are coming out of a sewer. It's very much like a zombie movie. All these mutants coming out of the sewers. He's trying to escape and he shoots like this elliptical hole in the wall and just jumps through into the next room. But if you
and
watch
it's like paper mache.
It's a paper mache wall. Yeah. So you're like, oh, it's not quite as cool. If they redid that now, it'd be like a foot thick, wouldn't it? You just like kick it through. One of the things I actually like about it is it's very kind of a perfect film in a sense. It's a very simple concept. And it just
it moves along really quickly. Yeah, I was going to say that.
You don't need to know that much about the characters. All that you're given is all that you need. And then you can like fill in the blanks yourself. But I think it's all just up there on the screen. And it explains
everything as well, doesn't it? It's like, oh, you could run away. No, you can't.
Yeah.
Oh, you've got to get him back in this amount of time. Oh, do I have to? Yeah, you do.
And he's like, can I just bring the tape back? And they're like, no, you've got to get everything back.
Yeah.
And then he can't find the fucking tape because then he finds that drunk who's wearing the president's wristband.
Which, that's another thing I've got wrote down because that's a bit weird though. Because he's getting punched and he turns around with a big smile on his face. Is that some sort of like weird sexual fetish thing?
No, I think he's just a drunk, but that guy is in loads of Carpenter films. I've forgotten what his name is.
It just stood out to me like a really weird sex thing because like there's obviously downstairs must be like where it gets
weird. The underground
weird.
Where all the weird stuff happens, yeah.
Yeah, because that rape, it's like a really weird rhythmic rape. Because that bloke's
clapping.
Oh,
when he's walking around and he just walks past the door.
Yeah, because that bloke's like clapping, which is very, very strange. He just fucking walks past. Nah, fuck that.
Well, I think Snake does the kind of the absolute bare minimum to kind of get the job done. And I think you see that when those guys like pounce on him and he just knocks them out with like an elbow and a punch.
Yeah, he's very quick at things like that, isn't he? Yeah.
So, I mean, I did think the stakes turned up every 10 or 15 minutes, something else happens. You're like, how the fuck is he going to get out of this, basically?
I love, though, that halfway through the film, he just goes and has a sit down.
Like, yeah, that's a really cool moment when he's just like, now what do I do? And he's just like trying to like gather his thoughts and he just picks up that dirty chair and sticks it in the rubble and sits on it.
Yeah, so fuck this. I don't know what to do. Oh, fuck it. I'm out of ideas. I'm just going to have a sit down. You don't see that much, do you? Like because I wouldn't say this was an action film.
No, not at all. But it feels a lot bigger and more action-y than it actually is, I think. That's the trick of the film.
Yeah. The film feels massive.
Well, it's not filmed in New York, strangely. I'm sure a lot of fans of Escape from New York already know that, but it was actually shot in St. Louis.
Yeah, wasn't it like an abandoned street or an abandoned estate or something like that?
Well, apparently there was this raging fire a couple of years or a year before, and it kind of gutted like a lot of downtown. So there were lots of businesses and apartments literally abandoned. So they had, before the city redeveloped that area and started putting the pieces back together, as it were, they kind of
free
went
rain.
In there. and shot. And Dean Cundey, who's the cinematographer, who's another kind of like amazing cinematographer. He's worked on Jurassic Park, the Back to the Future movies. God, where do you even start? Apollo 13. He's done most of John Carpenter's films, and they developed a camera that could like shoot with natural light. So
it looked lovely, didn't it, really, to be fair? Like how dark it was and how dreary.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything popped.
Yeah, well, that's because they had this special lens. I'm not sure it was like a Panavision or a Canon or whatever. I should have found that out, shouldn't I? But that's one of the first films that shot night for night, and it's only using the natural light from the street lamps and the fires and stuff.
Yeah.
Because if you watch a lot of old films, especially Bond films, and there's actually a scene in the new Mad Max, it's called a day for night shot, and it's meant to be night, but it looks obviously day, and they put like a blue filter over it, because back in the day you couldn't get cameras that would work at night.
Yeah.
And because like movie lighting wasn't the art that it was, they could never ever kind of make it look passable or credible. So you'll see in a lot of the old Bond films from the 60s and early 70s, when it is nighttime, it looks like daytime. They just put like a blue filter over it, which is essentially what they did. And there's a scene which ruins Mad Max for me, because I know they can shoot at night when the kind of truck breaks down and he's trying to get the wheels out of the mud. And that's got this day for night effect on it. Obviously intentional, but it just kind of like, it's a bit weird when they'd need to do that, unless they were just trying to make it look cartoony.
Yeah.
Just on the notation that James Cameron obviously was working on this, there was a set decorator painting sets under James Cameron physically. an actor called Bill Paxton, who was working
in
set building. Yeah, so like they were firm friends right from the off, because like they were working for New World Pictures, and that's kind of what began Bill's acting career. So he'd done little bit parts in this and that, and when like Cameron had his big break to write and make The Terminator, he's got the small part as the punk at the start of the film. Like the following year he plays a radio operator in Commando, and he was
I saw him in True Lies. Like I watched True Lies for the first time the other day, and he's brilliant in that.
Yeah, there's the sleazy car sales, and he's fantasizing about killing him.
Yeah.
Well, the studio didn't want, well, to be on the lead Kurt Russell we've discussed before, the studio didn't actually want Kurt to be in the film. The studio wanted Charles Bronson, but John Carpenter thought he was too old, and because Charles Bronson was like a major star at that point, and he'd recently had a big hit a couple of years before that with Death Wish, which has been remade actually this year with Bruce Willis, which people are now complaining about.
Obviously.
He didn't feel he was the right thing, because he was obviously too old, and he didn't want a seasoned actor to come on stock. I think because if you get a young director and like a very famous seasoned actor, you get like sparks flying, because he knows his job inside out. He's been on a million film sets. And then there's this young buck giving him direction, and eventually the actor starts taking over production.
Well, they had that on Batman 89 with Tim Burton and Jack Palance.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they didn't get on at all, because obviously Tim Burton would try and direct him, and Jack Palance would be like, nah, fam, I'll do what I want.
Don't forget your lucky deck.
Nice. Nice.
Well, the same thing happened with 2003's The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, when Sean Connery and Stephen Norrington, who directed Blade, they didn't get on at all. And they apparently came to physical blows on the set.
Huh.
It's a $60 million production, and I think Connery was getting like $17 or $18 million.
Fucking hell. And
apparently there's this scene where they have to walk down the road, like in like slow-mo, this like badass scene where it's like all them walking together.
The Reservoir Dogs scene.
They did one take, and then Norrington asked Connery if he could do one more take, and he was like, no. And he's like, you're getting paid $18 million. The least you can do is do another fucking take walking down a street. And apparently Connery like flew at him, and they had to be like broken up.
He sounds like a lovely man, doesn't he, Sean Connery?
Yeah, so preemptively, Carpenter didn't want that to happen with Bronson, so he was out. Then he wanted Tommy Lee Jones. This is a studio.
I've never seen a young Tommy Lee Jones. What does that look like?
Less leathery and pockmarked. I think he's in Coal Miner's Daughter. But I'll be damned if I've seen... He kind of appeared out of nowhere, didn't he, Tommy Lee Jones? With, like, The Fugitive and Batman. That's when I first kind of knew about him. Yeah. But he'd had, like, a massive career up to that point. But he had this, like... He kind of popped in the 90s, didn't he? Like, majorly. It was, like... The Fugitive. And then he was, like, in Batman.
I've only seen him as Forever. Two-Face. That's probably...
Okay.
I don't think I've seen him.
Well, you should watch The Fugitive with Harrison Ford. You might like that.
Yeah.
Or you may not. Would it be worth it? But Carpenter stuck to his guns and just wanted Kurt Russell. He'd kind of been a fan of Kurt. So Kurt was a Disney kid. He was in The Computer, wore tennis shoes and a bunch of other kind of Disney films.
Yeah, he'd not done anything too serious, had he?
No.
And then he was sort of a gamble, really.
He was. Well, his first big gamble was on Kurt was when he played Elvis.
Yeah.
Kurt was desperate to kind of break out of that mold. He did audition for Han Solo and not got it and stuff. So his career... at that point would have been kind of finished. And he credits Carpenter with kind of like not only renewing his career, sending it in a new direction, and but giving him all these iconic parts. And the reason Kurt Russell is still seen today in things like Guardians of the Galaxy, because it's a harking back to Escape from New York, you know, Big Trouble in Little China, Tango and Cash, all those films.
The I haven't last seen one, Tango not, and Cash. I want to see that.
The last one's not John Carpenter, but that's another like favorite of mine. It's just Kurt Russell playing to his strengths, and he kind of had that mold. He kind of played the same kind of thing over and over again, as you've seen in Guardians 2.
Mm.
But yeah, he absolutely credits John Carpenter, and they worked together so many times. He was like his Robert De Niro if he was Scorsese, basically.
Yeah, I can see that. That makes sense.
So what did you think? I've told you all the bits I like. I mean, what about the film did you actually like? Did you like Romero, that guy with the filed teeth?
Yeah,
like,
the big spiky zombie-looking motherfucker.
If you come in, he dies. If you do this, he dies. If you try and rescue him, he dies.
He reminded me of the cab driver in Scrooged.
Yes, he does, doesn't he? He looks, almost exactly with the same hair and stuff. Maybe they ripped him off because Scrooge is 1989.
Well, I did like how it started and how it's everything, pretty much everything is explained. Like, it would have been nice to maybe have seen little clips like The Purge. You know, The Purge starts where it shows everything going tits up.
Yeah.
Maybe that would have been a bit nice, but fair enough, whatever.
Well, they didn't have the budget, really, so exactly, she just sort of explained.
That's the sort of thing I'm sort of getting now. I'm seeing more of John Carpenter's films. He knows how to fucking stretch a budget. He does, doesn't he? And, like, I think it's a bit of a silly plot.
Oh, it is. Oh, it's ridiculous. But it's kind of...
It's played those... very serious.
Yeah.
So that sort of worked for me because it was quite silly. And then everybody else, he's taking it deadly, deadly serious. Like, there's not even one sort of wink where it's like, well, we know him having a bit of a fucking piss take here. But I've heard that that's what the sequel does a lot of. The sequel's a bit more campy.
It is. It's very campy. It's kind of very knowing. I mean, Bruce Campbell's in it in a cameo. Obviously, Bruce Campbell's famous, if you listeners all know this, from the Evil Dead films and the Evil Dead series.
I've seen the first one. I have seen the first one.
Oh, you've not seen the second one?
No.
Oh, you see that then.
Or the third. Gosh. Apparently the third's the bollocks, isn't it?
You might be in for a treat.
Maybe it could have got away with being a little less serious.
Mm.
But then, because Kurt Russell's character, because Snake's not a very, like we mentioned, he's not that likable.
He's not.
No.
But as I said, I think he's the most morally ethical character. By the time you get to the end...
He hasn't got time to be likable, though. He's there to do a job. He's got to do it because he didn't want to die. And he knows...
Oh, he's all about himself.
Yeah, so he's looking after himself, but he's still... Like, he tries to save that woman-ish, who I believe at the time was his wife, I think.
Mm.
But he tries to save her, but fuck the other one. Fuck the one's getting raped. So he's got like a bit of a weird...
I think the reason I get in the impression he's like an honourable man is because he's going to kill Harry Dean Stanton. Because he's like, you know what they did to Fresno Bob? You left us, Harold. And like, so they obviously must have been all part of the same...
Fresno Bob, where do you think he's from?
Bobville. I think the intonation is they're all part of the same kind of military team, maybe back in the day.
Yeah, or they pulled a big job or something.
Yeah, and like they've been a criminal gang, and they've all been like arrested at some point and put in this prison, and then he finally comes across Brain, as he's now called.
Yeah,
and he's gonna like rub him out for betraying them. So he must have sold them out at some point.
Who's not that smart, because he didn't really know where all those mines were.
He didn't. But one thing I did love was the Duke of New York's car with the fucking chandeliers on the front.
Yeah, he was good. Fucking chef. I liked him loads.
Isaac Hayes.
Yeah, he had that weird little eye twitch. I don't know if that's he's got an actual eye twitch or he just decided that his character would have an eye twitch. But I thought that was interesting. I liked him, but I thought he was... again, he didn't say a lot. One of the things I probably would have liked to have seen was a better action thing between them at the end, like a better
Snake only encounters the Duke in person once, and then he knocks him out almost immediately. And then he's just kind of like
running away,
or he's in that kind of big gladiatorial arena with Ox Baker, the giant 7-foot wrestler with the baseball bats with spikes in.
Yeah, that was dead good. That was where he smashed his head. Oh, that was class.
Well, apparently he had a wooden stake or a stick, a 2x4 at the back of his body, and then he literally hit him in the head.
with the
spikes, and they stuck in the wood. That's such a dangerous thing to do, but that's how they got that shot, with like sticking the nails through his head.
We need to stretch the budget, brother. We ain't got the budget to do this, so if you fuck up, you're dead. Sorry, mate.
Go, Kurt.
Yeah, don't miss.
You mentioned you said there was something to do with the third Escape from New York film. Did you say you uncovered anything?
I heard bits. I heard it was linked loosely to Ghosts of Mars.
Yeah, you're right. Ghosts of Mars apparently was meant to be the Escape from Earth script. Because at the end of Escape from LA, basically, he throws the world back into the Stone Age. Sorry, spoilers. Another dystopian ending, even though it's a lighter, more comedic film.
Right, okay. Snake more comedic, or is everybody around him more comedic?
I think the second one he's portrayed, because I think the first one is very much in the mold of a Western, like I said, of like a lone guy coming into town to clean up or do a mission.
Yeah.
The second film, they play that up even more. The score is less electronic and it's more kind of like guitar based,
okay,
and flamenco-y, but it still sounds cool. It's like ZZ Top-y kind of guitar music.
That could have been a bit more dramatic in the final fight scene, I think. Like,
yeah,
or even when the car chase, like... I don't know, maybe speed it up a little bit.
Well, I think what they do in the second one is they kind of make him more invincible and badass, which is cool. But I think in the first one, he's a bit like Indiana Jones in the sense he's not quite up to the task.
Yeah, because he gets knocked the fuck out.
Yeah, he gets by just about, but you're always kind of, he's not kind of like a Rambo or a Schwarzenegger-y type character that just comes in and just kills like 200 men with a gun.
Yeah.
That kind of came, I think, later with that explosion of like the Stallone Schwarzenegger movies. But I think in the second Escape from LA, they really play up the Western-y aspects. It's more of a Western type soundtrack. He's got two guns on each leg, like a gunslinger.
Okay.
But the third one was going to be called Escape from Earth, or Escape from, yeah. And they were either going to go to a space station and or Mars, and that's where the Ghost of Mars script was retooled. And they replaced the Snake Plissken character with, like, Ice Cube.
Yeah. Today was a good day.
And I've only seen it once. After 1994, after Escape from New York, he didn't really kind of catch that wave. I think Carpenter just knocked out perfect film after perfect film, at least until Big Trouble in Little China. And then there was a lull, and then he came out with us in the Mouth of Madness. But that run of films from, like, 76 to 1986 or 85. They're just every single one of those films. It's a bit like Spielberg. Like every film was a classic that came out of it.
Well, I enjoyed Ghost of Mars because I watched it. We mentioned it on the Thing episode. I watched it when I was about 11. And it terrified me.
Yeah, the Marilyn Manson zombies in it and stuff. And
I didn't like, you know, I don't know if you'll remember it if you've only seen it once. But, like, the people get infected, don't they? And, like, the camera, the way the cameras go straight up to the person.
Mm.
For some reason, I don't know why, but as an 11-year-old, that shit me up, and it fucking stuck with me for a couple of years. And then I watched it back a couple of years ago, and I just found it hilarious.
I need to rewatch it, because it's... apparently, you can see what it would have been if it was an Escape from New York or an escape movie.
Maybe now, if I know that, I can watch it differently. But, like, it is gash. It isn't very good. But, like, I've got, like, a weird nostalgia thing to it where I actually love it a bit.
If you liked Escape from New York, Toffer, and listeners, there's a film called Lockout from 2012 with Guy Pearce, which is set on a space station.
Uh-huh.
People essentially think they ripped off... Well, they did. I don't know. There's a guy in it. Guy Pearce plays this guy called Snow, who's basically Snake Plissken. He's sent on a mission, or he's going to die, to rescue, I think, someone's daughter off a space station. John Carpenter got wind of this, of course, and sued the company. And I think MGM got, like, not much in the grand scheme of things, €50,000. Carpenter got €30,000. And Nick Castle, the co-writer of Escape from New York, who, fact fans, played The Shape or Michael Myers in the original Halloween movie 1978, they all just settled out of court, and the court ruled in the favour that Lockout was a rip-off of Escape from New York.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how that is, though, because aren't all movies kind of homages or rip-offs of other ideas? So...
Yeah, like, why hasn't Tarantino been fucking taken to court after every film he's ever done?
Yeah, exactly. So maybe it's just the power of the filmmaker. You think, Tarantino's a genius, so it's okay. He's actually bringing attention back on what he's homaging, so it's okay.
Yeah, maybe. Be interesting to sort of see what counts as an actual rip-off.
Yeah, because I was shocked that they kind of got sued for that.
It's supposed to be a decent film, though.
Yeah, apparently it's really good. Mm-hmm. I saw it in passing when it, I think it was on at someone's house. I haven't really watched it, but I'm actually going to go and now we've done this, revisit it, because I think a mix of this and Ghosts of Mars is what Escape from Earth or Mars would have been, basically.
Okay, so it is 2017. Apparently there is a remake that is being done at the moment.
Yeah.
You are put in charge. How do you remake this film?
Oh, good question. Well, I mean, they've been talking about this remake for as long as I can remember, and especially in the last 10 years, Gerard Butler was attached to it for a really long time. He was going to play Snake.
No, that's not a bad idea. He's a good-looking lad. Weird mouth, though.
So I don't know. If I was going to remake it, I'm trying to think of an actor who I would actually put in that role. Now I think we've got Guardians of the Galaxy now in the ether for people to see, and anyone listening to this has obviously probably seen that by now. I still think Kurt Russell could do it, so I think you could to do it again. Kurt Russell, I'm sure, would return to the role if it came up and he had John Carpenter's blessing.
Yeah.
But off the top of my head, I can't think of anyone. If I did do it, I wouldn't do it shot for shot, but I think you'd have a preamble of society falling apart. You could obviously do it at a lot larger scope.
Yeah, you could make it a bit more real as well. Like, you'd use some of the actual events that have happened. You could use actual footage of riots.
In fact, I'm going to Google now, Escape from New York, and then remake, and then see if anyone else is attached. I know Gerard Butler's actually dropped out. 27th of March 2017, this is The Guardian. Robert Rodriguez is apparently attached to this remake.
Okay, all right. So fucking Machete. Put Machete in, is he?
Machete. Yeah. I mean, Danny Trejo could do it for sure.
Yeah.
But I think that's what you need. You need some kind of likable, kind of unlikable,
Ice Cube.
Charismatic kind Ice Cube. Of person to do it. Not Ice Cube, no. Ice Cube looks like this permanently vexed rabbit. He just kind of like...
Have you seen...
He just curls his lip and kisses his teeth at people. I don't know. That probably wouldn't work.
Have you seen Zootopia?
I have not.
Not Zootopia. I'm full of shit. Secret Life of Pets.
I have actually, but I don't. I threw it last year.
The little rabbit that Kevin Hart plays. That looks like Ice Cube.
That looks like Ice Cube.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say Idris Elba to play Snake Plissken. I'm so bored of people saying Idris Elba should be this.
Idris Elba could be anything he wants, mate. If they redid Alice in Wonderland again, Idris Elba could be Alice.
If Idris Elba's so good, listeners, why does he look shit? And why is everyone saying The Dark Tower and him playing the gunslinger stinks?
So allegedly, it's not a very good film.
Yeah, no, that's what I've heard too. So, they screwed the pooch, apparently.
Apparently, yeah.
Apparently, it's been so badly done, someone said it's... even if they tried to spin off a TV series, it's like the foul taste this film leaves. It means it's going to have to be left alone for one or two decades. I think Mark Bernardin said it, actually.
So, what don't you like about this film? Or is there anything you don't like about it?
No, it's one of my favourite films of all time. There's nothing I would really change. I mean, that spinning glider bit where it falls up, but they're like minor gripes that you don't notice, and they're on for half a second. I think it rattles along. It's stripped down. It's just a bare bones film. There's a concept. The characters are all really cool. And even the secondary characters he meets along the way, they're all kind of very much, I couldn't imagine anyone else playing those characters kind of thing, like the cabbie and stuff.
Yeah.
It's just a really great film. The music's amazing. It's just a really well put together film. And it's like if John Carpenter was like...
On top of his game, weren't it?
On top of his game, smoking hot, and he was just knocking out classic film after classic film. If you start watching anything post Escape from New York, you'll just see, you're like, fucking hell, that was good, that was good, that was good. So, yeah, at some point we will do Big Trouble in Little China, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I mean Kurt Russell.
Yeah, what did you think
Kurt
of Escape
Russell?
From New York, virgin brain, seeing all these old films for the first time with your cynical, modern... I've seen Avatar in 3D, even though I know you haven't.
Nope,
world.
No. I've seen Titanic in 3D. Does that help?
Was it good in 3D?
Yeah.
Did the 3D work?
Yeah, it did.
Because that's a
really
post-conversion.
Well. Really well. Okay. Yeah, really well. Like when the, I don't know what you call it, that big thing falls.
Yeah, the thing breaks off.
Yeah, and it just falls towards, that looked really good. I shit myself a little bit.
So was it worth it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Considering it's like nearly 40 years old in 3 or 4 years, it's like 36 years old, this film.
Mm-hmm. I liked how quick it moved. It was very well paced. It's very easy to watch. Like, this is a film that you could just have on while you're doing anything.
Rewatchable.
Yeah, very, very rewatchable. Like, I could just have it on now and I could just sit there and look at it and be like, oh, I love this bit. This bit's dead good. And then crack on doing something else and then come back to it. It's like, it's another film as well that if it's halfway through, I'll sit down and I'll watch the rest of it.
Yeah. Because you don't. No, I'm the same. If I'm channel surfing and it's like on in the middle, you go, oh, I'm just going to keep watching this.
Mm. And I thought Kurt Russell was brilliant in it. Very, even though he didn't have a lot to say, he was still very charismatic.
Yeah, well, I think that's that was the kind of like I said before, the launching pad of his career now. He went on to kind of do all these films because Escape from New York was so iconic.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like there's like you can see Snake or Kurt in a lot of the things he does, like, you know, there's Guardians and Big Trouble in Little China and stuff. Even though the different characters, you can see like the grounding or the foundation of that starts with Snake Plissken.
Definitely. I can see now why it's very cosplayed, because it's quite easy to cosplay, really.
Well, you know what? I thought to cosplay it once, but if I do it, I want to do it exact, because the one thing that annoys me is like half-ass cosplay. And I'm sorry, folks. Most of cosplay is half-ass.
Is he wearing spandex trousers?
No, they're a particular kind of... you can actually get them from like fan sites now. It's the patterning and the camouflage. People actually make trousers, so you can get the proper trousers. And yeah. If you look hard enough, it might take a few months, but you can get the boots. They're these kind of ones. I think they're the ones you see in Mad Max as well.
Okay.
They're like a leather boot, and they've got like this actual piece of metal like stitched onto the front. And the little things on his toes are actually golf cleats. They cut off golf shoes and glued to the boots.
Oh, okay.
So those little claws on the end of his boots are that. So I think it's kind of easy. The only thing you can't really do is get the jacket perfect, but I'm sure there's enough Snake Plissken fan site costume places and people out there that can connect you to someone that can actually make one, or you can actually get one.
Yeah.
It's doable, but I've seen a lot of really bad Snake Plissken, so I'm kind of quite protective over him.
I do have one question, though. Hawk, or Hawk, whatever you want to call him.
Bob Hawke.
He
got a job for you, Plissken.
Call me Snake. Like, he keeps telling him to call him Snake. And at the end of the film, when he calls him Snake, he says, call me Plissken.
Yeah.
Is that just he's just fucking with him? Or is there like a symbolic reason for that?
Well, I think when he first sits down, I think he's like, my friends call me Snake. So yeah, he's kind of fucking with him. And then when he's like, hey, you're cool now, you've done the mission, he's like, go fuck yourself. I'm not your friend. The name's Plissken.
Yeah. It's just his anti-establishment gimmick. Yeah.
And also, like, he obviously switches the tape because Donald Pleasance just goes, well, it's thanks for your help, bye, fuck off. And he's like, all right, motherfucker.
Yeah,
have bitch. The American Bandstand tape and not the actual. That's why he's like destroying the tape that's going to save the world at the end. And it fades to black. Can I nominate the next film?
Hit me.
I think the next film will go a bit romantic comedy slash. And I'm going to send you Into the Night with Jeff Goldblum and Michelle Pfeiffer.
Okay. Okay.
The reason I say this is because I can't justify any good reason why I think this film's good, but it's one of my favourite films of all time. It's a pre-Fly, like, before he blew up Jeff Goldblum. But for some reason, I might even go as far to say, I don't know why I'm saying this, but it's my favourite film of all time.
That's fucking random.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. You've got multiple layers. Like, on the outside, you're this cynical internet wanker. You've got a soft inside.
On my show, I'm this cynical wanker. In real life.
You love a rom-com. Mate, one of my favourite films is One Fine Day. That's got fucking thingy in as well.
Gay.
Love
Never
that
seen
film.
It. Okay, I'm hitting you with, Into the Night. We can do One Fine Day with me.
Let's do them at the same time then. One Fine Day is a tremendous film. It's a beautiful film.
Strong words. Right. One Fine Day and Into the Night are going to go up against each other. Should we do like a dual episode?
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Movie fights.
Well, mine's got George Clooney in it. George Clooney was Batman. Not a very good Batman, but he was still Batman.
Yeah, well, mine's got Jeff Goldblum and he was the flying a rapist in Death Wish. So beat that, Clooney, you fuck. Well, there we have it. We did find out that Escape from New York is actually worth it. One of my favorite films of all time. We'll be with you next episode with One Fine Day versus Into the Night. Beautiful. Are they worth it? We'll find out.
Beautiful.
Two men fading into middle age as they remember films with Michelle Pfeiffer and a different leading man. She gets around, doesn't she, that woman? Little whore.
Oh, fucking hell.
What?
At Was It Worth It Pod on Twitter. Ethan, where can they find you?
Ethan McKinley UK. You can also see my YouTube channel, Questionable EMCQ. If you type that into YouTube, you'll find it. And my site is ethanmckinley.com. You've got 300 episodes of the Terminator podcast I did with Ellie Fitzgerald. And we're going to come up with something else shortly. And you can see my scathing movie diatribes and random interviews with people from Scientology to the movie world on the Questionable channel.
Beautiful. Follow us on Twitter. Like our Podomatic page. Leave us a review on iTunes. All that normal shit that people ask for. And have a nice day.
A fine day. One fine day. As you go into the night.
Writes itself.